All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies. We have a very special edition of Torah Studies. Tonight, Ray Bellman is sponsoring tonight's class in honor of the third yard site of her dear husband, Morris. Morris's yard site is the 26th of Iyar. And so tonight's class is dedicated to Moshe ben Avram Zelig. Avram Zelig. So indeed, your husband's neshama should have an aliyah and should be continually ascending and getting nachas from you and the whole family and keep on doing mitzvahs in his honor. It's a very special thing. Thank you for the sponsorship. Okay, so tonight we have a very special topic. The topic is Shemitah and Yovel, sabbatical and jubilee years. These are very interesting mitzvot in the Torah. We're going to look at them, analyze them, why, what's the purpose behind it, and then hopefully gain some spiritual and personal insights that we can walk away with. So I'll tell you a story. We were having an issue at our house last a week or so, where the kitchen sink, there was water coming through the pipes. It wasn't really through the pipes. It was through kind of like the drain. Like the drain thing was kind of, I'm a plumber, right? The drain thing. I'm sure there's a name for it. The thing. No garbage disposal. But the actual, like, drain was a little bit loose from the rest of the, from the sink, right? The drain in the sink. Who would have thought? Anyway, called a plumber, a guy that I know for a long time. And he comes over yesterday and he's fixing it. And it's a very simple fix for him. And he's a religious fellow. And he starts asking me, he's not a Jewish guy, but he's a religiously minded fellow. And he asked me, what is Judaism's understanding of righteousness? What does it mean to be righteous? So he's asked me like the Jewish definition of a tzaddik, basically, right? A righteous tzaddik. Like what is, huh?
Fixing
that sink and not charging me. I will tell you, he said that right after I wrote him a check. So I could have said it's not cashing the check or handing me back the check or ripping up the check. I didn't think that quickly on my feet. But I did share with him an idea that I think is related to this week's class, but I'm not going to tell you what I told him now. You'll have to wait about 55 minutes and I'll tell you then what it is that I shared with him. Okay, so let's jump in. So please open up the Chumash to page... Oh no, this is a real teaser. This is really like... I'm not divulging the information until the end. So we are up to the last two Torah portions in the book of Vayikra, book of Leviticus, Bahar B'chukotai. So we've had a lot of double portions. And here we have another one. The first of the two, Bahar, begins on page... 810, 811. And with this, we close out the third book of Torah and we jump into the book of Numbers, which always is read right before the holiday of Shavuot, the giving of the Torah. But this portion as well, or these portions as well, are also set in proximity to the holiday of Shavuot. All right, Ray, please get us started. The Torah portion, Bahar, opens with the mitzvah of Shemitah, continues with the mitzvah of Yovel, and let's see exactly what these mitzvot until 8:11. Page 8:11, chapter 25, right at the top.
God spoke to Moshe in the desert at Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, when you come to the land that I'm giving you, the land should rest a Sabbath to God. You may sow your field for 6 years, and for 6 years you may prune your vineyard and gather in its produce. But in the seventh year, the land should have a complete rest, a Sabbath to God. You should not sow your field, and you should not prune your vineyard.
So far we have no working the field in the seventh year. Continue, please. 8:13.
You should not reap for yourself the aftergrowth of your your previous year's harvest, which sprouted on its own, and you should not pick the grapes which you had set aside for yourself, for it will be a year of rest for the land. The produce which grows on its own during the Sabbath of the land will be ownerless and thus available to you to eat, equally with everyone else. You, your male and female slaves, your non-Jewish hired worker and lodger who lives with you. All of its produce may be retained in your house to be eaten by your domestic animals, so long as there is sufficient produce remaining in your land for the wild animals.
So we really, thank you, we really have two components of the mitzvah of Shemitah, which is basically the sabbatical year of the land. Number one, you can't work the land. No harvesting, no cutting, no working the land in the seventh year. Number two, the crops that grow are not yours. The crops belong to everyone equally. Okay, let's continue with the Yovel, the Jubilee year.
You should count for yourself 7 sabbatical years. 7 years, 7 times. Days of these 7 sabbatical years will amount to 49 years for you.
That's like, just in case we didn't get the calculation, right? 7 times 7. So the Torah spells it out.
The following year, you should announce the Jubilee year with shofar blast in the 7th month on the 10th of the month. On the Day of Atonement, you should sound the shofar throughout your land.
Mm. So 1 second. So let me just mention. So basically, you're doing 7 sabbatical years. So the 7th sabbatical year would be year number 49 from the right? Year 49. The 50th year, so you're not working the field in the 49th year. And the 50th year, you again don't work the field, and you again don't, it's not your land or whatever, it's not your crops and that sort of thing. So so we have 2 years in a row now that this sabbatical is happening. One, the Shemitah, the sabbatical, and one, the Yovel. And we also just mentioned that that in that 50th year, at the beginning of the year, 10 days in, on Yom Kippur, which is known as the 10th day of the 7th month, even though we call it the first month in the calendar year, but it's the 7th month from Nisan, when the Jewish people were born with the Exodus. So it's 7 months later is Rosh Hashanah, so even though the calendar year is number 1, but in the Torah's count it's number 7. Anyway, on Yom Kippur, you sound the shofar, and that kind of rings in the Yovel, the Jubilee year. Continue, please. Please continue, 8:15, a few more verses.
Each person's hereditary land allotted to his ancestors when they first entered the land of Israel should return to his possession if it had been sold. A Hebrew slave who chose to remain with his master indefinitely should return to his family. The 50th year will be a Jubilee year for you, but it may not be extended further into the next year. Just like during a sabbatical year, you should not sow, you should not reap for yourself its aftergrowth or pick its grape which you have set aside for yourself. Because it is Jubilee, if you sell produce from this year, your money will become restricted as if it had been dedicated to the Holy Temple. Just like during the sabbatical year, you may eat its produce and retain it in your house so long as it is still freely available for the wild animals from the field.
And the final verse? Continue?
The next one?
Yeah.
If a person sells a field from his hereditary land and his son then buys it from the purchaser, the property should be returned in the Jubilee year to the father who is its rightful owner.
Thank you. So, it's a long Torah portion, and you read most of it. But thank you. This is the opening. This is actually the first major section of the Torah portion of Bahar, which again talks about the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year, and the Jubilee year. So basically, sabbatical year, like we mentioned, there's no working the field, and you don't own the crops. It's owned equally by everyone. The Jubilee year is basically the same, with an addition. What are the two additional elements of the Jubilee year?
Returning property.
Property returns, good. And what's the second one?
Slaves.
Slaves, right? Slaves go free. So the land returns to its original owners, and slaves go back. Slaves return to their original status of freedom.
Can a slave stay and then they have to put something through his ear?
Yes. So a slave really should only be for 6 years. In the seventh year, a slave should go free. But if the slave says, I want to remain a slave forever, so then you pierce the ear of the slave, the Torah says, and the slave remains a slave forever. And as Rashi says, it means forever until the Jubilee year. So the Jubilee, it means for the entire unit of time until the Jubilee year. And the Jubilee year resets everything. It resets the land, it resets the human condition, if you will, and everything goes free. Everything reverts back. Okay, so we have a lot of themes that we can talk about. But I want to point out something that might have gotten lost in this conversation. In fact, it's the name of the Torah portion. What is the name of the Torah portion? Bahar. What does Bahar mean? What does Har mean? No, it's a pirate. Har, Har. Seriously. No, Bahar means mountain. Bahar means in the mountain or on the mountain or at the mountain. What mountain are we talking about? Mount Sinai. In fact, indeed, the opening verse says, God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying the following commandments. Simple question. How is Mount Sinai, why are we suddenly going back to Sinai? Sinai happened like a book ago. Yeah.
There's like a theme of returning.
Okay, good. Right, so there's a theme of returning. Okay, hold that thought for a second. But from a very simple perspective, we had the experience at Sinai, the giving of the Torah. That was in the Torah portion of Yisro, back in the book of Exodus. Then we had the sin of the golden calf. We had the forgiveness and all that stuff. We had the commandment regarding the tabernacle, the Mishkan, the building of the tabernacle, the collection of the items, building of the tabernacle, dedication of the tabernacle, all of the laws regarding its utility, its use, its construction, how the sacrificial service should go. And suddenly now the Torah says, oh, and this is what God told Moses at Mount Sinai regarding sabbatical years and Jubilee years, when you enter the land of Israel. Because it's not relevant in a desert. These laws didn't kick in. In fact, the very next verse says, God said to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the Jewish people and tell them, when you enter the land that I'm giving you, then this is when you should observe the sabbatical year and the Jubilee year. So the question is asked, Rashi addresses it right at the beginning, why is Mount Sinai used as a reference point here? Suddenly we're bringing back Mount Sinai? Mount Sinai is like, I don't know, it's so a book ago, huh?
Old school.
It's old school, yeah. Mount Sinai, whatever, used to be cool. Kidding. Still cool. But like, how is it coming back? So, Mike, please read text number 2. So now we're jumping into the Torah studies text. Does everyone have a copy or a book? Everyone's got it? Okay. Take a look at page 98, text number 2. And here is Rashi. I feel like I'm probably going to have to break this down a little bit, but let's read through it.
On Mount Sinai, what special relevance does the subject of Shemitah have with Mount Sinai? Were not all the commandments stated from Sinai? However, this teaches us that just as with Shemitah, its general principles and its finer details were all stated from Sinai. Likewise, all of them were stated, their general principles together with their finer details from Sinai. This is what is taught in the Torah.
So pause for 1 second. Rashi points out, Rashi asked the question, Ma'inyan Shemitah Etzel Har Sinai? What does this mitzvah of Shemitah have to do with Har Sinai, with Mount Sinai? Why are we mentioning Mount Sinai in this discussion? So he says, the Torah is telling us that this mitzvah, with all of its details, not just generally have a sabbatical year, but no, what does it mean to have a sabbatical year? Don't work the field. Don't sow the field. Don't harvest the field. Don't reap the field. Right? If you give it to your animals, it has to be freely accessible to other animals as well. Right? All of those details were all stated according to the preamble here at Mount Sinai. That's what the Torah says. These are the words that God said to Moses at Mount Sinai. And what do we have here? The mitzvah of Shemitah, the sabbatical year, together with all its details. So Rashi says, what's the message? The message is that at Mount Sinai, God didn't just tell Moses, here's an outline of the entire Torah. Here's a general overview of the 613 mitzvot. And as we go along, I'll fill in the details. That's not what happened. You would think, to what level of detail did God get into Torah and mitzvot on Mount Sinai? Famously, God delivers the Ten Commandments. God speaks the Ten Commandments, or the first two, whatever. So the Ten Commandments experience happens. Moses goes up the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, comes back down, sin of the golden calf, and the rest is history. But during those 40 days and 40 nights, Moses learned the entire Torah. And God told Moses, Moshe, all of the mitzvot. But to what degree of specificity? How detailed did God get? Rashi tells us, right here in this Torah portion, God got very detailed. God got super detailed. Why is this a novel idea? Because when you look at Torah, so a lot of times you'll have a mitzvah mentioned twice or three times. And one time it's mentioned generally, and maybe the next time it's mentioned in more detail. So for example, and Rashi is about to jump into this, I'm explaining a little bit as you know, before we read the next paragraph. In the book of Devarim, the book of Deuteronomy, it's called Mishneh Torah, which means a repetition of Torah. It's not really a repetition, but it's as Moses is standing in the last few weeks of his life, so he's giving the people a final address before his passing, and he reviews a bunch of mitzvot. And in that review, he gets into a lot of detail. And one might have thought, that Moses was only learning and explaining details at that point in time. Maybe God only told Moses a general framework of the mitzvah. Listen, here's the general idea, and I'll let you know more details when it's relevant. You know, if it's about a mitzvah for when the Jews go into Israel, they don't need to know it for 40 years. Why does God tell it to Moses at Sinai 40 years earlier? Okay, because maybe they're going to go right in. I mean, God kind of knows the future. Okay, you can get into like questions of predestiny and free choice and God's awareness and whatever, which is not, it's not today's topic. But the point is, you might have thought that God only told Moshe the general outline of Shemitah and Yovel, but not all the details. So the Torah says no. At Mount Sinai, this is what God told Moses at Mount Sinai. All of these details. And Rashi says, what's the message? Just like this mitzvah was stated, taught to Moshe in all of its details at Mount Sinai, so to every single mitzvah. Even the ones that begin vague and only get detailed much later, all of those details were originally taught to Moses at Mount Sinai. All of the details of Torah and the mitzvot that we have in Torah, no matter where it appears in the book, they were all given then. With probably like one or two exceptions of a mitzvah that only came up at the request of certain individuals, like the daughters of Tzelafchad, who they wanted a portion of land in the land of Israel. They didn't have... The father passed away, he had no sons, only daughters, and they asked Moshe. Moshe said, well, let me ask God, and Hashem gave him a new mitzvah. So, but barring those exceptions, every mitzvah was told in all of its details to Moshe by God at Mount Sinai. Make sense? Okay, continue, please.
And why Shemitah uses the example to prove this rule, I would suggest as follows. As the plains of Moab, Moses reiterated the majority of the laws of the Torah to the Israelites before their entry into the land of Israel. This reiteration comprises most of the book of Deuteronomy. Now, since we do not find the law of Shemitah of land reiterated on the plains of Moab in Deuteronomy, we learn that its general principles, finer details, and explanations were all stated at Sinai. Scripture states this phrase here to teach us that just as in the case of Shemitah, every statement, i.e. every commandment that was conveyed to Moses came from Sinai, including their general principles and finer details, and that the commandments delineated in Deuteronomy were merely repeated and reviewed on the plains of Moab, not originally given.
So Rashi says, so why is Shemitah used to teach us this idea, this amazing idea that God told all of the details to Moshe at Mount Sinai? Because Shemitah is one of the mitzvahs, or maybe the mitzvah, I'm sure there's a few more, that is not repeated in the book of Deuteronomy. Moshe doesn't go ahead and repeat the mitzvah of Shemitah later on. And so, therefore, it's not like the mitzvah, we couldn't have had any thought that the mitzvah of Shemitah was taught twice. The mitzvah of Shemitah is only taught here, so we know, and here the Torah says it was taught at Mount Sinai, so here it's a clean mitzvah. It's a clean mitzvah that we know that the totality of which was taught at Mount Sinai. And so we extrapolate from there, that just like this mitzvah, in its totality, because it's not repeated later on. Just like this mitzvah in its totality was taught at Mount Sinai, so to even the ones that are repeated with more detail, all of that detail was originally taught to Moses at Mount Sinai.
It's almost an argument in every verse, though, because this is the one that's never repeated, so clearly it's completely taught.
So you're saying maybe the point is this is the exception, not the rule. Okay. So how do we know it's the rule? So Rashi says the fact that the Torah specifies that this was said at Mount Sinai, when it could have just not mentioned that at all, it's coming to teach us. I hear what you're saying. You know, the more unique this one is, the more unique we make it or portray it, the less latitude we might have to compare it to the others. Rashi's saying that's the point. It's one of those logical things that could probably go either way, but this is the way that it's falling in this line of thinking. Okay, but now we ask a very simple question. It's a klutz kasha. Klutz kasha is like the obvious question that no one thinks to ask. It's so obvious, no one actually asks it. So here's the question. You're telling me that why does it say Har Sinai? This is what God said to Moses by Har Sinai. Why does it mention Sinai, regarding the mitzvah of Shemitah? To tell us that Shemitah, just like Shemitah was said in all its details at Mount Sinai, so too all the other mitzvah. Why not another mitzvah? Why don't we look? Why is Shemitah the example? Why is Shemitah the mitzvah from which we learn out all of the other mitzvot? Why? What special qualities does Shemitah have that it's the prototypical mitzvah that teaches us this idea? And I know what Rashi said. Rashi said because this is the one that's not repeated elsewhere in Deuteronomy, so that's the one that we can, notwithstanding the logical go either way, that's the one that teaches us. But that itself is a question. Why didn't God choose another mitzvah to not repeat later on, or that Moses should not repeat? And that one should become the prototype. Are you with me on the question? In other words, you can't say, like Rashi says, why Shemitah? Ah, because that's not repeated later. Why? It's like a circular argument. This becomes the prototype because it's prototypical. But who made it the prototype? God. Why? We haven't answered the question. We said God chose it as a prototype because clearly God chose it as the prototype. But why? God could have taken any mitzvah and the Torah could have framed any mitzvah in the same way. Any of the 613 could have been the one that it says this was stated at Mount Sinai, and not be repeated later in Deuteronomy, and that would be the one from which we learn to apply to all the other mitzvot that they also were taught in all their details at Sinai. It seems to be that there's something about the sabbatical year from which applies to all other mitzvot outside of this idea of Sinai, or maybe intrinsic to this idea of Sinai. In other words, this mitzvah is not incidentally or accidentally the prototypical mitzvah that teaches us that every mitzvah was stated in all details at Sinai. This mitzvah, for some reason, which we're about to discover, is very intentionally the prototypical mitzvah that teaches us that every mitzvah was stated in all details at Sinai. So, what we've done so far, we've described the mitzvah of Shemitah and the mitzvah of Yovel, the sabbatical year and the jubilee year. We cited Rashi's explanation, the first Rashi in the Torah portion, where he asked the question, why is it mentioning, why does the Torah tell us that this mitzvah was taught at Sinai? And he says, aha, it's coming to teach us that this mitzvah was taught in all its details at Sinai, and so too every other mitzvah. And our question is, why was Shemitah, how did it luck out to be the one mitzvah that the Torah specifies, that this one was taught in all its details, and this is the one that we're going to learn to apply to every other mitzvah, that they also run by the same rules? Why Shemitah? What's special about the sabbatical year?
Aren't there a lot of other mitzvot, though, that are sort of encompassed?
Yes. Say it again.
That are encompassed in the sabbatical and the jubilee, that are within
that, I mean, ways to treat the land, ways to treat humanity, ways to treat possessions, ways to
feed animals, even wild animals, not your own animals.
And even the resting.
Right.
You know, creation and resting. I mean,
so you're saying it's a good mitzvah.
Well,
but there are a lot of them that are good. There has to be something foundational.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying, is it's got so much in it that covers so many different ethical ways of living and Jewish.
I hear that. I like it. We're going to go in a little bit of a different direction,
okay. But
not necessarily, you know, contradictory, but it's a different angle.
It seems like you're dropping hints about the repetition. And this is a mitzvah of repetition on a cycle of seven. We've got 7 weeks leading up to the Yom of the Torah. Mm-hmm. We've got 7 days of the week.
Seven years, seven times seven.
Sevens. So I'm thinking there's a lot more wrapped up in the sevens.
Okay, repetition. Good. Fantastic. Good. Hold that thought. We're gonna pick up on that soon. Yeah.
So I did cheat by looking at the front page.
I don't even know what's on the front page.
It says discipline is necessary, compassion is crucial.
Oh. Okay.
So it's about the balance between, like, so an example would be the week. Like, for 6 days of the week, you work with, like, discipline, and then you're given the seventh day of the week is about rest and compassion. And it's like a lot of Jews err to one side or the other. Like, I feel like Reform Jews err too much on the compassion side, but then a lot of Orthodox Jews, like, they're like, I have to do these things in the right way. And in doing so, they forget to be compassionate. You know,
right.
Forget, like, if somebody came up to them while they were praying and the person needed to say something that was important, they would, like, I'm davening, you know?
Right. So how, like, dare you? I'm speaking to God.
Maybe that person really needed something. So, like, yeah.
First of all, I love all of that. It's fantastic. I love the angle, the approach you're taking, and I love the examples you're giving. And I feel like I should share a story about that. So there was once a fellow who knocked on. There was, like, a wealthy fellow, very religious fellow, and this fellow was a beggar. He was hungry, hadn't eaten in days. He knocks on this fellow's house, and he was in the middle of something, probably a mitzvah or something, right? He's like, well, I can't help you. He's like, I'm hungry, I'm starving. So he, like, tells his servant to give him, like, just an old piece of fish. Anyway, so the man, this is not going to end well. Oh, no, it's not going to end well. So the man eats the piece, the fellow who's hungry eats the piece of fish. A few days later, he gets sick. So this man is very religious, so he visits him in the hospital. And then he visits him again in the hospital, and then the man passes away, so he participates in the funeral, and then afterwards he wishes the family, it's Menachem Avil, he comforts the mourners, and he says afterwards, look how many mitzvahs I did with one piece of fish. I visited the sick, I participated in a burial, and I comforted the mourners. Right? So sometimes you could be frum, you could be religious, like, how many mitzvahs can I rack up? And meanwhile, like, hello. So it's a very dark humor, but it's dark, like, religious, and like that type of genre. I've said it, like, a very few times the last several years, and it's never really gotten it, like, a full-on chuckle. Like, I have other material that works better, but it's more of a, like, poignant story. It's more of a story that brings out a point than, or like a, yeah, I know, it's hard to characterize. But anyway, I think that's what you're saying is definitely true. Any other thoughts on this? Why it's a prototypical mitzvah?
Die also.
Oh, you're saying practically, it's good to leave it. Yeah, we found that. We've found that out. That it's good to rest, yeah.
One of the common things I get when people find out was in the military is, thank you for your service. And today, for some reason, I looked at the woman who said that, and I said, if you knew what I did, you wouldn't be so thankful.
And now she's like, well, what'd you do? All right, so let's take a look at some themes. If we want to understand why Shemitah, the sabbatical year, is a prototypical mitzvah. So let's indeed jump into the themes. You know, we've alluded to some things and we've had a lot of good ideas that have come up. Let's take a look at some classic texts about the Shemitah, about the sabbatical. So the first theme that we come to is that Shemitah is about, and I'll use two words here in Hebrew, it's about emunah and bitachon. It's about faith and trust. I mean, what are you doing in the seventh year with the field? Nothing, right? I mean, you're harvesting, you're not planting it, you're not tilling it, you're not plowing it, whatever people do with fields, right? You know, if you're a farmer, then you would know, right? Then we know all these things, but, right? So I'm not a plumber nor a farmer. It's a confessional night. So you can't do any of that stuff. And so the obvious thing that comes to mind is, oi, what are we going to eat? What's going to happen to the land? So this exercises our faith in God that He's got things under control and our trust that He's going to take care of us. Let's take a look at what the Talmud says about this. Mike, the other Mike. Text.
We came up with my name.
Number.
No.
Did we? Text 3. Mike the Elder. How am I going to remember that? Mike the Elder. Mike the Elder. Do you like Mike the Elder?
Yeah.
It has. Oh, you love. Okay, if you love. All right. All right. If you love it, good. I'm okay. Text 3 goes to Mike the Elder.
Text 3. A disciple came and asked Rabbi, what's his name?
Abahu.
Rabbi Abahu, what is the reason for the sabbatical year? Rabbi Abahu replied, the Holy One, blessed be He, said to Israel, sow your seed 6 years, but omit the seventh, so that you may know that the earth is mine. They, however, did not do so, but sinned and were exiled.
So Rabbi Bo gives us gives like a commentary in the end. They didn't keep it, and that's why we were exiled out of the land. Okay, but aside from that, what is the point of the sabbatical year? To know that the earth belongs to Hashem. It's a point in faith emunah, to know that God runs the show. Rashi explains in the parentheses.
Rashi, so that you may know, etc., and your heart will not grow arrogant over the produce of your land and forget the yoke of His kingship.
It's easy to forget God when things are easy and when the good times are rolling, so we take a break and we remind ourselves where it's all coming from. That's one text. Let's quickly move on to text number 4. This comes from the Sefer HaChinuch, a book that explains very basic, very, or not basic in a negative, in like a very fundamental reasons for every mitzvah. So here we have it, the Chinuch on the mitzvah of Shemitah. No, Sarah, please.
The purpose of this mitzvah is to affix the notion that God created the world in our hearts and minds.
Like, yes, to affix the note. To affix the notion in our hearts and minds that God created the world. It's somebody translated it literally in the way the Hebrew syntax rolls. Yes. Yes.
To affix the notion in our hearts and minds that God created the world. The matter of the world having been created.
Yeah, the translation is a little bit awkward.
So as the verse is, in 6 days he got on the seventh day, in which he did not create anything, he imposed rest on himself. This mitzvah serves to remove, uproot, and eradicate from our minds the notion that the world was always extant, that is, that it was not created, but always was, a belief held by those who deny the Torah and seek to destroy all its principles and break through its walls. So we are commanded to dedicate time, day by day and year by year, for this matter, by counting 6 years and resting on seven.
Interesting. He talks about how, right, it ties into the JLI class. For those of you taking the JLI class, it ties into a lot of what we're speaking about this week as far as the Kabbalah of time, where basically what we're saying is don't be mistaken to think that the world always was. Only God always was. The world has a beginning. In fact, when was the beginning? In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. That was the beginning, right? That means there is a beginning, and it wasn't always. So the point over here is that that's also the theme behind the sabbatical year, is taking a break and recognizing that the world, in other words, stop worshiping the world and recognize that God indeed is in charge. Continue, please.
This whole process is similar to how we count the days of the week, dividing them into 6 days of work and a seventh-day rest. For this reason, in addition to resting during this year, God, blessed be He, commanded us to render all produce of the land as onerous. The purpose of this is so that a person will remember that the land that produces fruits for him every year does so not by its might and virtue. And there is another benefit. The outcome of this is that a person will add to his trust in God, may he be blessed, because anyone who finds it in his heart to give and abandon to the world all of the produce of his land and his ancestral inheritance for an entire year, and educates himself and his family through this for all of his days, will never have the trait of stinginess overcome him too much, nor will he have a deficient amount of trust.
Okay, good. So here we have the kind of a second inflection on this, is that to not only remember that God is in control and God stands outside this whole system of creation, but also to remember that to trust in God. So it's about faith, which is emunah, kind of like belief in God, and that God is greater than the earth. And number two, to have trust that even though I'm not going to plow and sow and till and reap and harvest and whatever, nonetheless, God is taking care of what's going on here. See, the last line is, this person will never have a trait of stinginess, overcome him too much. If you have to give everything away for a year, you're kind of letting go of holding on too much, nor will he have a deficient amount of trust. In other words, if you can give it away, then you trust that God is going to provide. Let's jump into text number 5. Here we have the Rebbe's phraseology and insight into this mitzvah. Lolly, please read this one, page 103.
The plain sense of Shemitah is that the land must rest in the seventh year. Shall not sow your field, nor shall you prune your vineyard. In the seventh year, one must suspend all forms of work in the fields that produce the staple food by which man lives. And if you should say, what shall we eat? The Torah answers, know then that I will command my blessing for you in the sixth year, and it will yield produce for 3 years. Thus, the underlying concept of Shemitah is that once in every 7 years, a Jew is expected to divest from all mundane needs. The person is to disengage from all involvement with the land that would yield the bread that is his or her sustenance. Rather, they depend completely on God that he will provide sustenance.
So the Rebbe says very simply that every 7 years we hitch our, what's the expression? We hitch our
wagon.
There we go. We hitch our wagon to God, right? We say, God, take us where we're going. You know, we're not putting any physical things in place here. Like there's no plan. So we're following you, right? This is just absolute trust. Divest from all mundane needs. Disengage from involvements with the land and depend completely on God, that God will provide sustenance. So typically, we have to make a plan. If we hope to have a plan, if we hope to have what to have, then we have to make a plan and we have to do this stuff. But 1 year out of seven, God says, don't make a plan. I got the plan. You trust my plan? You ready to follow if I lead? Okay, it's a little scary, right? It's like, it's scary. Once every 7 years to give up your job? I mean, most Jews were farmers. It's not only a job that earns money that you can then use to buy food, it's how you make food. So it's a scary proposition, but again, this is the depth of the mitzvah. Now, let's take a look at another text, text number 6. And then we have a lot of different texts here, and we're going to weave it together like a mosaic. Steve, please read text 6, page 104 from the Akedah Yitzhak.
Through counting 7, Shemitah cycles 6 years of work and the 7th of rest, the Torah informed us that we were not sent to this world to be servants of the land, rather for a different purpose, one more honorable and wondrous, is man's purpose, and working the land is intended only in order to feed ourselves and acquire other needs so that we can achieve that higher purpose. This is the intention of the gift of the land of this nation, as stated here previously. The purpose of the Jewish people's entering the land was was not to be servants of the land, to work it for its produce, to simply amass wealth. Rather, the intention was only so that they would be able to sustain themselves and live peacefully according to the will of their creator.
So, thank you. According to this, Akedas Yitzchak, what is the purpose of Shemitah? Right, priorities. Get our priorities in order. Right, otherwise, we would be slaves to the land, slaves to materialism, slaves to wealth, slaves to food. And so God says, 1 year out of seven, enough with the materialism. No more materialism. No more working the land. No more eating, obsessing about the food. What am I going to eat? What am I not going to eat? Stop with all the materialism. Think about something higher. So once every 7 years, it's about transcendence. What does that kind of sound like? Shabbat, right? Shabbat is a day also of transcendence. On Shabbos, we stop working and we can go to shul and spend hours. And typically, if you have a job, you have to get to the office early in the morning. So you can't pray for 3 hours in the morning on a regular day. I mean, unless you start really early. But like you're running and you got this and you got that and you got all these things that are occupying you. But on Shabbos, you're not working. So you can daven. You can show up, you know, shul, 8 o'clock, 8:30, study, prepare for davening. Davin, Fabrang, I mean, where you go? Right, there's nowhere to go. So you spend 4, 5, 6 hours in synagogue and you connect spiritually. It's transcendence. So it's a day, I'm speaking about Shabbos now, it's a day to cut the cord between you and materialism and transcend and connect with Hashem. The same is true with the sabbatical year according to the Akedah Yitzchak. It's a year, the sabbatical year is a year in which we divest ourselves from materialism, from our work, from our labor, from working the land, from obsessing about the land and food, etc. And we dedicate this year to God. So what did they do back in the day? Can you imagine for a second, a populace of farmers, once every 7 years, dedicating themselves to Torah and prayer. Scholars. Once every 7 years. Just like Shabbos is the oxygen after we're wrung out through the week. 6 days you shall work. Squeeze for every ounce that we have to give and do. And Shabbos, it's like the oxygen. It's like we can breathe finally. I'm thinking of those football players that are, you know, that run and, you know, it's usually the larger guy, but they have, you know, after they need the old oxygen, they take those that thing of oxygen, especially when they play in Denver. They can finally breathe. Shabbos is a shot of oxygen. It's like, oh, I can get away from this and actually breathe. Every 7 years, the farmers became scholars. How beautiful is that? The farmers, talk about shaping a people where you're not stuck being a farmer. That's not your destiny. You're not stuck in the societal position of your digging in the earth, producing food that other people are going to eat. That's not the totality of your being. Every 7 years, you uncover, you reclaim something transcendent about yourself. You're not... There was once a Shabbos trigger video that showed people doing labor jobs, like, you know, labor-intensive jobs, and as the work week goes on, they morph into the tool. Become a hammer. Become whatever it is, right? You kind of become the tool. You become a farmer. I mean, think about it. We identify people by what they do. When you meet somebody, hi, what's your name? What do you do? Maybe that's, you used to be a way that people introduce themselves by what they do. It becomes part of our identity. Every 7 years, you divest yourself of that material identity and you reclaim your spiritual identity. And you tell a farmer, you too are a scholar. You too can dedicate yourself completely to God, to Torah study, to prayer. A year filled with that, it's an amazing thing. So this, in a nutshell, is the mitzvah of Shemitah. I just summarized text 7, by the way, from the Ibn Ezra. So we don't have to read that instead. Yeah.
So, you know, it's really interesting, like this text right here, that you could really build a whole philosophical study of what it means to be a holy nation. So because it talks about, you know, this this gift of the land to this nation, but the intention is to elevate this nation, this land, and this nation You will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, to a level of holiness.
Correct.
Which really you could use this text and the whole concept of Shemitah in discussing and exploring why Israel, I'm talking the state of Israel, the people of Israel, but also what is our purpose?
Right, and he says here, I think about the land, that don't look at the land as a mean, as an ends for itself. It's a means to an end. Use the land to achieve something greater. But if you never climb out of it, then that will be the ends. If you're always farming, so then you're a farmer. Unless you take a break and you recapture what that is. So you're right, it is transforming the very relationship. It's like what Shabbos does to work. It transforms our relationship to work, that we're not bound or defined by our work. So the same thing is true with the land. We're not defined by the land. We can transcend the land, but in doing so, I think your point is, we elevate the land in the process.
You elevate the land.
Because you bring it, number one, to its purpose, and you show that it's something to work with and not to work for, almost. Right?
We don't elevate the nation.
And the nation is elevated, exactly. So with this, the Rebbe explains why Shemitah is a prototypical mitzvah. We're about to read text 8. We're skipping text 7 because I summarized that. Text 7, the Ebenezer basically writes that every 7 years, the farmers would study. And they would dedicate a year to Torah study and prayer. I mean, that's what they would do. They would go to yeshiva for a year. And it was an amazing thing. Text 8 is where the Rebbe explains the interplay between Shemitah and the other 6 years. Because based on what we just said, man, we should have Shemitah all the time. Shemitah is so awesome. It builds faith in God. It builds trust in God. It allows us to transcend materialism, transcend the hammer and the sickle and the plow and the food. It allows us to regain our nobility and transcendence. Shemitah all the time. So why is it that the bulk of time is 6 years you should work the land and only on the seventh you take a break? Why is the minority this reclamation of spirit, and the majority jumping into the earth? That doesn't sound right. Comes along the Rebbe, and the Rebbe explains the interplay. Dan, did you just read?
No.
No, not yet. Okay, text 8, 107.
This approach of transcending the world completely, however, is not meant to be the norm. Most of the time, quantitatively speaking, the Jew must be involved in mundane matters for the purpose of refining the physical world. That is why the world was created with the divine name of pain, the numerical value of which is the same as a team of nature. For man must relate to things as they are in the natural order, in the way prescribed by him in Torah, and therefore he purifies and refines the sins of nature. On the other hand, there are certain times when the Jew is enjoined to step out.
So here the Rebbe gives a classic example of the worldview of Hasidus and Chabad and Judaism and everything. And that is that although it's healthy to build faith and trust and transcendence and leave the material world behind, the reality is that most of our time is meant, 6 out of 7 is meant to be invested in the world. Why? Because that's where we make a difference in the world. But in order to make a difference in the world, in order to make the world a better place, we have to also have those moments of escape to gain the perspective. And then through that perspective, we can return into the world to then make the transformation. So here's the deal. If you never had a sabbatical year, you might become the plow. You might become the sickle. You might become the shovel. You might become the scythe. Is that how we pronounce it? Yeah. We might become the tools of farming. We might become the vineyard or the wheat field. We might become the earth. So you need the seventh year. But if you just had a seventh year, so now you're floating. Oh, I love God. I believe in God. I trust in God. God's going to take care of me. I don't need to work. Transcendence, study, and prayer. No, who's going to farm the land? What's going to happen with the earth? Neglect it. You want to go to heaven, but God created this earth. Now who's going to take care of it? So 6 days, 6 years, 6 days and 6 years. You got to work it. The seventh, you step out and you get some oxygen to then get back in. And the Rebbe says, this is text 9. I'm going to summarize text 9 because it's a longer text. And I want to get to the Jubilee year because we haven't touched that yet. So the Rebbe says, basically, this is why Shemitah is the prototypical mitzvah that teaches us about all other mitzvot. Because every mitzvah has this duality. Every mitzvah has the duality of being the will of God. When I do a mitzvah, it's the will of God. It's the transcendent will of Hashem. So it's a transcendent experience. I'm connecting with Hashem. I'm giving God a hug. It says that every time we do a mitzvah, it's like we're hugging the king. So we're hugging the king. It's an unbelievable thing. And yet, within every mitzvah, there are practical parameters and laws governing the physical performance of the mitzvah. You have to have a lulav that looks like this, and an esrog that looks like that, and a sukkah that's this big and not that big, right? A matzah that's this amount and not that amount, baked under 18 minutes, not over 18 minutes. In other words, every transcendent mitzvah connection experience is also grounded in very practical boundaries and borders. It's all grounded in the box of materialism, but physicality. And thus, every mitzvah represents and contains this duality of high and low, transcendence and immanence. Being without, staying within. All has that duality contained in every single mitzvah. So what is the prototypical mitzvah that teaches us that this experience will take you out, but also stay inside? Shemitah. Shemitah is the prototypical mitzvah that takes you out of the world. But Torah says, not just the seventh year is the sabbatical year. The Torah says, "Sheishanim tizra sadecha." 6 years you should sow your field, and the seventh you should rest. So it's all part of the mix. So the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year. Bottom line is, it's the duality, it's the convergence of transcendence and immanence, which is at the core of every single mitzvah. Yes, right. We're a composite. Our composition mirrors this, exactly.
Yeah. The only other thing, it kind of reminds me a little bit of, we talked about it in classes before, about how when you look at the mitzvah of observing the Sabbath, it says you will work for 6 days and then you will observe the Sabbath. So people always forget that first part. So
work 6 days, right.
Yeah.
It's like, it almost seems like a preamble. And what you're pointing out, and what we pointed out before, and what this highlights is, it's not just a preamble to get to the, but it's a necessary part of the mitzvah. Mitzvah is to work the 6 days to make a difference. And you'll need a Shabbos to then make the difference. But you got to make the difference.
If you don't work 6 days, Shabbos
is Shabbos. Yeah, you can't rest if you didn't work. What are you resting from, right?
Good.
Yeah.
Can't experience him through our senses, so like that the mitzvot are the way to bring God into the physical realm, but also the way that, like, the only way that we can experience God, because we have bodies. So it's, I don't know, it's interesting because it's like, I guess it brings God to earth, but then maybe also, like, is the thing that gives God pleasure is like to be involved in the physical.
Right.
Because he,
exactly.
he also can't, like, I mean, I'm assuming that, well, he can. I mean, I guess he can do anything.
But he doesn't typically, but right. He
like,
no, the truth is, the Talmud asked, there's a discussion in the Talmud, for example, regarding charity, where somebody asked one of the rabbis, if God wants us to support the poor, so why doesn't God just do it himself? And the answer is because God wants us to do it. So it's not that God maybe can't do it, God could theoretically do it, but God doesn't do it. He wants us to do it. So we become God's hands and feet on earth to make a difference. Yeah, God could fix it up himself, but that's not what he wants. He put us here. That's our mission. Okay, now, let's jump quickly into the Jubilee year, because here we have a paradox as well. When it comes to every mitzvah, when it comes to the sabbatical year, we have the paradox of transcendence and immanence, rising above but staying within. With the mitzvah of Jubilee, unbelievable themes, we also have this paradox. And okay, let's do text number 10. Anne, please read text number 10, page 111.
A simple perspective on the purpose of the mitzvah of Yovel is that God, when he be blessed, wanted to inform his nation that everything is his, and in the end, everything will return to those to whom he wanted to give it at first. For the earth is his, as it is stated, for all the earth is mine.
So what is this speaking to? It's speaking to the aspect of Yovel that says that all of the lands that were sold go back to the original owners, i.e. the original way that God apportioned the land of Israel to different families, the ancestral fields and ancestral properties. So basically God says, okay, you can buy and sell whatever you want, but at the end of the 50 years, in the 50th year, it's all going to reset. It's like the Etch-a-Sketch. It's like draw whatever you want. Everything's going to go back if that resets it or just erases it. I don't know, just work with me, right? It's God is resetting the whole thing. What does this bring out? Who's in control? God. How much are we in control? Right? What's the implication? Implication is we think we make a difference. We think we make, not a difference in like a positive way, but we think like our actions have permanence and, you know, ooh, I changed something. That's mine now. I own it. I bought it. You sold it. You bought it. I sold it. We think we move things around. And God's like, yeah, no, it's still mine. You own the land? No, you just used it for a little while. And then you're going to move on. And I'm still here. And the land is still mine. Lashem ha'aretz umalah. This is such a great phrase. That quotation, for all the earth is mine. Oh, sorry, it's kili kol ha'aretz. Okay, that's all. It's a similar phrase. Yeah, there's a Jewish, a long-standing Jewish custom that in a book that you buy, especially a Jewish book, you write the words LaHashem Haaretz Umalo, which means God, Hashem Haaretz Umalo, the earth and everything in it belongs to God. You say everything belongs to God, and then you write your name, right? It's like everything belongs to God. So the book is not mine, but if you find it, give it back to me. Right, that's the connotation. Right? That's the message here. God owns everything. We think we're machers. Oh, look at this. I built that. I own this. I sold that. Oh, I run this. It's like really 50 years, etch a sketch, everything's back to the way God wanted it originally. Right? So what this evokes is humility. It humbles people. It's like you think you're such a hotshot. Nah, God's in control. That's a power, that's a theme, powerful theme of Yovel. At the same time, look at a contradictory theme. David, please read text number 12. We're skipping text. I think we're skipping a text. Let's skip 11. Let's go down to 12 from the Ralbag. Listen to this. Totally opposite theme.
There is another purpose to the law that property returns to its original owner and slaves are freed during the Yovel. The idea is that people who endure daily hardship should never lose hope, armed with the knowledge that they will one day be set free. In this manner, they will be motivated to persist in their efforts to do everything to stay alive and well, not despairing under the assumption that they have no hope. Indeed, we observe such conduct with people found in such desperate situations. Their enduring slavery is the reason for their persistent disadvantage.
So the Rabbah says it's almost the opposite theme. And let me break it down very simply. What he says is a person who's a slave, a person who's in a difficult place, might think, this is my destiny forever. I'll always be disadvantaged. The rest of society is free, and I will always be a slave. And so Torah says, nope, don't define yourself by your disadvantage. In fact, every 50 years, okay, that sounds like a long time, and it kind of is, but whatever. But right, the concept is, in 50 years, or not in 50 years, but at the 50th year, you're free. You're free to go. What it does is, it gives a person hope, and it gives a person human strive. It allows a person to dream, to strive, to have pride in what it means to be a human being. In other words, what this does is it encourages the human spirit. It encourages dreaming. It empowers the human spirit to keep on growing. And it's not only a slave, it's for all of us. It's whenever you're in a negative place, God forbid, know that there's a better opportunity up ahead, that God is going to allow you to become free of this challenge, and then you're going to rise higher. So what this does is, it encourages the human spirit. The first explanation of Yovel was saying, you human beings, you don't really accomplish anything anyway, it's all mine. It's humbling. This is lifting up a person. So the first explanation of Yovel, that God is the owner and what we do doesn't really matter, right? That makes a person feel lower. This makes a person feel higher. It's a contradiction. You know what it's like? It's like, I know what it's like, Bahar Sinai. Remember the opening words of the Torah? These mitzvot were said, where? At Mount Sinai. What was Mount Sinai known for? It was the smallest of all the mountains. How do I know this? Okay, I measured it. I'm kidding, I didn't measure it. Text 13, final text. Karen, please read this one, page 114.
The mountains trembled before God. Is that Tabor?
I think so, yeah.
Tabor? Mounts Tabor, Hermon, and Carmel were quarreling with one another, claiming, I am most befitting to be the host of God's glory. Surely he will bestow his grace on me. God, however, bestowed his glory upon Mount Sinai, which is more humble and meeker than all other mountains.
And what it evokes is the sense that where does Torah reside, or where does God connect with one who is humble? But then why wasn't Torah given in a plain or in the Dead Sea? Or like, you know, in a very low place. It was still given on a mountain, but on a low mountain. And so the Rebbe explains, and Chassidus explains, that the message is not just lowness, being low. The message is, like a humbling message, the message is you also need to be a mountain. But even as you're a mountain, your ego is in check. You're a low mountain. Or you're a high, low, right? You're low high and a high low. It's not even a thing. It's not even a phrase right there. But the point is, a healthy human being has a combination of the opposites. Where they have human pride. They have spiritual pride. They believe in themselves and they believe that they can accomplish. And even though they might be in a negative place, even though they might be a slave right now, they know that the Jubilee is coming and they're going to rise up again. So they have that human pride. At the same time, you know that God's in control. And you never let it get to your head. Even when I'll be successful, it's still due to God. And what can I really create on my own anyway? I buy and sell and make money, and what is it? What do I take with me anyway? Is it really mine? Is there really permanence in what I do? If not, for God granting a permanence. So on the one hand, I need to have confidence. On the other hand, I can't feel arrogant. This is the duality. And it seems like a paradox, but it's not. It's not. It's a strength. It's an inner strength. Coupled with humility, true humility, and being humble before God. So God is in control, and I am meant to put in the effort. It's the same thing we said before. Shemitah and Yovel represent similar dualities. It's the duality of transcendence and immanence, of being high and being low, of taking a break and putting in the effort, of recognizing that my efforts make a difference and I can climb out of this. And ultimately, God is in control. And what we do may not be the final say about things. And so in the final analysis, when my plumber asked me, what does Judaism say about being righteous? How does Judaism define righteousness. So here's what I told him. The first person who was considered righteous, who was called, well, Noah was called righteous. But God says, I love Abraham. Abraham is the first Jew. And who is Abraham? Some insight that I've shared before in those Torah portions. Abraham is someone who was so righteous that when the angels came to him, he offered them a hot meal. Because that's what it means to be righteous. What it means to be righteous is, of course you're holy and you believe in God and you have faith in God and you know that God's in control. But when someone needs your help, you're there for them. Right here. Not up there. Not in the sky. Not giving them a rotten piece of fish, an old piece of fish, to do more mitzvot. But helping them right here. That's what righteousness is. It's connecting the highest and the lowest and making a difference in the here and now. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.